the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590, The Fan, Blake Murphy, J.D. Bunkus, Ailish Forfar. Give them a follow at their names on the socials. Subscribe, rate, review, all that good stuff. Fan Morning Show, wherever you get your podcasts. Joining us now, played in by, unfortunately, I tried to arrange with her a song to play her in with, but the order got juggled up and it played at 6:30 instead. So I apologize to our next guest, Blue Jays writer at The Athletic, Caitlin McGrath. Caitlin, my sincerest and deepest apologies that Fall Out Boy was used on the playlist before you came on this morning.
I was so excited. I was so excited for my Fall Out Boy, but it's okay, Blake. I forgive you. I know you tried, so next time. Now I just have to come back on.
Speaking of Fall Out Boy or Boys Who Fall, Jordan Romano injured walking his dog. I know that the Blue Jays have had some very weird injuries in the past, like Robbie Ray getting hurt carrying his kid, Glenn Allen Hill falling through a table in what I can only imagine is a wrestling brain moment. Caitlin, where does Jordan Romano tripping while walking his dog rank in terms of bad bum luck spring training injuries?
Yeah, it sounds like it's like less serious than Robbie Ray falling down the stairs with his child, but it's also not as funny as Kevin Pillar sneezing and doing something to whatever. So I don't know. I mean, I expect that it is a little embarrassing maybe for Jordan, but it's also the good thing is that it doesn't sound like it's serious. I think it happened a couple days ago at this point, and he's scheduled to throw a bullpen today. So that's a good sign. You know, they're not really like shutting him down or anything like that. And so I think as long as everything goes well today, he still has a few more days to like continue resting that ankle. And I mean, there was really no signs yesterday when we were talking to Charlie about it that they're worried he won't be ready. I think it's just a little bit of a kind of one of those spring training injury stories that you can laugh about later.
Obviously, we bring you on for the hard-hitting analysis. What kind of dog does he have?
I think it's a Doberman. His name is Otto.
Oh, no wonder he tripped. That's a big dog.
Yeah, I have not met the dog, but one of our reporters has met the dog. So he was our source on that. But I think there's a photo out there on Twitter from one of the reporters, Rob Longley, of the Toronto Sun. He met the dog before, so he had the scoop on that.
I gotta see him fall. It's my favorite kind of dog. I gotta see him fall with the dog on video for me to believe this story. I can't buy this. Like, this is the ultimate liars who lie. Like, Romano has no reason to lie. He's a very honest guy. I know he's a good dude. He's come on
the show
many times. He's a friend of the show. And so it's hard for me to say this about him publicly, but hurt myself walking the dog. I've never heard of a person like that's not even an injury that a person in a senior citizen endures. Like, that's not a thing. That's not a thing that's ever happened in the history of anybody. Like, when has that happened?
Okay, but I would think the same thing about Kevin Pillar strains an oblique sneezing.
No, but that happens.
That's happened to multiple professional athletes. I sneezed with a dumbbell in my hand during the pandemic and cracked a rib. It's not great. Okay, so there was some non-goofy, non-dog related news yesterday. Caitlin, I know Dunedin has been a little slow, a little boring. You had your Blue Jays roster projection 2.0 up at The Athletic earlier in the week, and not a lot has changed there. Not a lot's changed with the battles. However, we found out yesterday that Jose Berríos will start opening day for the Toronto Blue Jays. What do you think went into that decision? What is Charlie Montoyo looking for in naming Berríos the opening day starter?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't come as a total shock. When I was like thinking about it, even back in like the off season when we didn't even know when baseball would be happening, it was sort of a toss up to me between Kevin Gausman and Jose Berríos, just because, I mean, those are the two guys that you kind of have brought in recently. They have the talent and the pedigree to lead your rotation, and they're also like the guys that you're paying the most, which tends to be the guys that get the big opportunities. And so I think with Berríos, like, it's a little bit, you know, that he is kind of the present and future of this organization. He also came over from the trade last year, and he was excellent for them when they needed him to be. He instantly like gelled with the team and gelled with the culture, and he also showed a huge sign of faith in the club and what they're building by signing that 7-year extension. And so these were kind of more like the intangible things I think that probably went into it. And then there's just also the fact that he has really good stuff. He, you know, has He's been one of the most durable major league pitchers over the last few years. He's got really good stuff to get guys out. And I think you could look at this rotation and, you know, some days you could maybe say Kevin Gausman's number one and Berríos is number two. And I think other days you might see Berríos looking more like a number one and Kevin Gausman looking like a number two. And so really to me, it's a toss up, but I like the choice of Berríos. I think it's a nice nod to him and the sort of future that you're building with him. And you're going to see Kevin Gausman go out there the next day anyway. And so I think it's a good way to start their rotation as well. They're both are really different pitchers as well. So it gives those two different looks, which I think will be advantageous as well for them.
It's Berríos' seventh major league season and eighth time through spring training. So I'm not too concerned necessarily, but have you seen anything in his two spring starts? He's given up 8 runs over 3 innings, 9 hits, only 3 Ks to 2 walks. Have you seen anything there that's concerning, or is that just spring wrinkles being ironed out?
Yeah, it sounded like those first few couple starts he was really more sort of like working on things, like I want to throw this pitch, I want to get it here, I'm really not worrying about results. But after that, after the two sort of Grapefruit League games, he did pitch in a sort of backfield minor league game that I was watching, and he looked much better. Now, granted, obviously the who we were facing was, I think, like low A guys or high A guys, or a combination of low and high A guys. So it wasn't quite major league hitters, but he did look a lot more sharp. He pitched like 5 innings. He was getting his pitch count up. He was getting the swings and misses that you're typical of him, and he came out of the game and said he felt much better, and he kind of was like, that was me pitching more like how I would pitch in a game, whereas before I was more pitching like I was just working on some things. And so it seems like he has a method, like a lot of pitchers, like, you know, Ryu is very like methodical as the way that he built his spring training. He really doesn't worry about results. I get the sense that Berríos maybe a little similar in the sense that he has plans early on, and then he sort of works his way into getting into that peak game shape. And so I think he'll be starting in the game tomorrow, I believe, as long as it doesn't get rained out. I would expect that one will be him really kind of rounding into that in-game form that he wants to be in.
So you mentioned Gausman's going to go number two after Berríos, and what that sets up in the back part of the rotation is Ryu, Manoa, Kikuchi. And I like the idea of splitting up Ryu and Kikuchi, both because of the handedness and because those are two guys who, you know, those are the two guys that you might skip a start sometimes or get a sixth guy worked in there or have a shorter outing. I also like, and tell me if I'm wrong, but this feels like something Alek Manoa would like. Obviously, you want the home opener start. That's the highest energy one. But Manoa getting to start the first road game at Yankee Stadium has to be pretty cool for a guy like that as well.
Yeah, and obviously it's where he made his debut, and so not that I would think anything would faze Alek Manoa, but this especially won't faze him. You know, he's been there, he's pitched there, he's used to it, and I kind of, when I was also sort of figuring out the rotation, I sort of thought they would either do the version that they have released and that they're doing, or they could flip Kikuchi and Ryu, just because Ryu has had some success against the Yankees. But, you know, Ryu's been your guy, and I kind of see why you want him to get one of those home starts, just because he has been with the team for 2 years now, and he really hasn't had that, like, sort of traditional April or March or April home opener in Toronto. So it feels like, you know, it was good to give him that earlier start as opposed to the fifth start. So, yeah, but Alek Manoa, even we talked about with him yesterday, and he's excited for that start. He obviously loves pitching in, like, sort of big games. He loves pitching against the Yankees, these division rivals. We all remember last year when we could hear his whole family screaming for him, because I guess the crowd wasn't very big because it was that doubleheader, like, weird early game. So his mom, I think he confirmed yesterday, his mom will be there again when he's starting. So I'm sure he'll be looking forward to that, and we will. And it'll be a good start. I'm excited to see Manoa this season, just because there's always that conversation around, you know, can he build upon his rookie season? Is he going to, you know, have a sophomore slump, anything like that? And I loved Alex's answer yesterday when he was kind of asked about that. And he says, like, I never think about going into start and pitching badly. Like, I don't, you know, like, a sophomore slump has not even entered my mind, because I don't think that way. And so that's kind of what we expect from him, and I think it's going to be a really exciting season to watch him have a full season in a Blue Jays uniform.
We're talking to Caitlin McGrath, Blue Jays writer for The Athletic. So I'm glad you and Blake explained why Ryu looks like he's the number three starter ahead of Manoah, because I think that the way most people look at this stuff is through just the lens of, well, who are the best guys? That's how you stack this rotation. It makes sense, but where are you at in terms of your understanding of Ryu's spring? Because during the offseason, it was a pretty big point of conversation. When we had Pete Walker on our show, he expressed that he felt like there was some offseason stuff that Ryu was going to be able to work on and bring him into this season feeling fresh. Danny Jansen reiterated the same thing. But again, those are guys that have a real stake in this guy's success. They're not going to throw a teammate under the bus. He's not somebody who is, you know, English speaking, who is going to give, you know, long explanatory or long answers explaining what's going on with him. But we also know that, like, he's a prideful dude, that he's desperate to have a big bounce back season. Where is your understanding of Ryu's kind of conditioning and his arm and just his, or the optimism around him coming back to the season where he looks more like the 2020 version rather than the one in 2021?
Yeah, it's interesting because it has been a quiet spring, and you know, we haven't even heard that much about Ryu, and I don't know if that's maybe us not asking enough about him or the fact that there's like some other stuff going on, and we were kind of wondering about like Berríos and Gausman. You're trying to get to know Gausman and Kikuchi, and so I think almost Ryu has like fallen under the radar a little bit, and maybe that's just because we've known him for a few years. He has his like sort of own little methods to spring, and you kind of just leave him at that and see how he kind of emerges for the season, because he again, like, he doesn't get too concerned with you know, results in spring. It's just kind of how he pitches. I mean, I guess I'll kind of just reiterate what I feel like is the feeling around the Blue Jays, and the feeling is that he is going to bounce back, and the feeling is that, like, maybe last year there was other stuff going on, and, you know, not that I know everything that was going on, but there was just, like, some stuff going on with him, I think, and maybe that lent itself to him not having the results that the Blue Jays were hoping that he had, and that he was hoping that he had. So there seems to be a lot of quiet optimism around him that he'll figure it out. I think, like, also the nice thing about the way that they've built this rotation and sort of the depth that they have is that I think there's a lot less pressure on Ryu. I think the last 2 years going into the Blue Jays season, he really did need to be the ace of their staff. And I think in 2020, he largely was. And last year, not so much. I mean, there were other guys that emerged, and so it wasn't as impactful. Robbie Ray, you know, obviously had an amazing season, and Alek Manoah and even Steven Matz came up pretty big. And so there was a pretty group effort last year in the rotation, and so Ryu's results didn't stand out as much, or it wasn't a huge impediment to the team. And so I wonder, you know, this season, if there's going to be even more of that. Like, Berríos and Gausman are leading the way. Manoah is looking to have a big season. I think there's going to be a lot of eyes on Kikuchi, and to see if the Blue Jays can kind of figure out how to help him be that first half all-star that he was. And then you have Ryu, but you also have, like, waiting in the wings a guy like Nate Pearson. So are the Blue Jays going to be able to, you know, skip the occasional start or give Ryu an extra day by inserting Nate Pearson in there? Are they going to be able to really use Ryu optimally and only have him out there for two times through the order and then bring in a guy like Nate Pearson or maybe even a Ross Stripling? Like, so I think that, you know, obviously Ryu is going to want the results to be there, but I think the Blue Jays are maybe in a good position to put him in situations and in opportunities where he can just perform better because they have the support around him, or they can give him those extra days, or they can have Nate Pearson, like, waiting in the wings. And so that his starts can be shorter, or that, you know, anything like that. And so I think that's what I'll be watching for with Ryu. And obviously he has the stuff, he has the command. He's a guy that should age well. And so I think it's about waiting and seeing kind of how he pitches those first few starts out there.
We're speaking to Caitlin McGrath, Blue Jays writer at The Athletic. And Caitlin, in addition to laying out how the rotation is going to set up, Charlie Montoyo let slip yesterday that the lineup the Blue Jays used on Thursday, or yeah, today's Friday, on Thursday, no idea what day of the week it is, was what he envisioned the opening day lineup being. That stands out because, I mean, first of all, I know you talked to Mark Shapiro and had a great Q&A with him at The Athletic that went up yesterday. And part of the discussion was about adding Matt Chapman and what that means for this team. But him being seventh in the opening day batting order is just like, it makes you chuckle as someone who's excited to see the Blue Jays offense. Within that lineup, though, Alejandro Kirk was the catcher. Danny Jansen and Reese McGuire were both out of the lineup. Biggio and Espinal both in. Biggio in the outfield, Espinal at second base. Do you think that Montoyo was being completely forthright with that being the potential opening day lineup, or do you think there's still wiggle room for Biggio, Espinal, Jansen, Kirk to shake out a little differently?
Yeah, so I talked to Charlie after the game, and I think there was some miscommunication with that being the opening day lineup. I think that it was more so that he was just saying that the particular order of the first four could be how it shakes out. Or also he may have just been saying that it was like, maybe that could be the opening day, like being, you know, vague about it. So I think there was a little bit of miscommunication. I think there was certainly elements of that lineup that will be that could be present on opening day. But I do think that Danny Jansen will be the opening day catcher. I don't think that Kevin Biggio will be playing right field necessarily on opening day. And so I think that I think it was interesting, like, how I think he had Guerrero batting second yesterday. And I think that's what piqued some of our interest too, just because he wasn't hitting there last year. That was Bo's spot mostly. But there's a lot, you know, there's a lot out there that says maybe your best hitter should hit second and like the MVP should hit second. And so it's interesting how the order was arranged. I am kind of curious to see if that sticks around. But it also depends. Like, some guys like to hit in a certain spot. And so I don't know how Guerrero felt about hitting in the two hole yesterday. Or if he likes to hit a little bit lower like he normally has been. But yeah, I mean, like, the thing with this lineup is that there's so much you can do with it. And like you said, Chapman hitting seventh, like, I mean, that could be where he hits, right? And that is pretty incredible if you think about this lineup where you have, you know, hitting above him, Springer, Guerrero, Bichette, Teoscar, maybe Gurriel, like, and you're going down the list and then you're finding him and he's, you know, he's there and hitting seventh. So, yeah, I don't know. I think there's still going to be a few more games where there's going to be some experimentation on the lineup before we know, like, this looks like the opening day lineup. So hold tight. We'll probably get another tweet or another, like, you know, graphic from the Blue Jays where we can say, okay, this looks like the opening day lineup. So hold tight on that, I think.
All right. Caitlin McGrath, Blue Jays writer at The Athletic. Great Q&A with Mark Shapiro up that went up yesterday, in addition to all your great Jays coverage. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning, and enjoy the last little bit of Florida, because it is snowing outside here. I just looked outside and it's snowing. So enjoy it while you can, Caitlin.
All right. Well, thank you, guys. And next time I expect Fall Out Boy, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. I can promise that if Vic doesn't throw it under the bus. Caitlin McGrath, Blue Jays writer at The Athletic. So, a lot of good stuff from Caitlin there. It's been an interesting spring in terms of there's not a lot of competition for the prominent jobs. So something like how the rotation shakes up and how they envision laying that out is really interesting. And, you know, Barrios being the opening day starter, I'm thrilled that he's supposed to get the nod tomorrow. I'm on pre and post game on Sportsnet 590 The Fan again for tomorrow's spring training game. So it'd be nice to get a look at him and break that down. But JD, the Ryu side of things, where is your confidence level in him having, I don't want to entirely say a bounce back season, because he wasn't terrible last year, but he went from being a Cy Young caliber guy in 2018, 19, 20 if he had enough innings, to being what looked like a mid to back end rotation guy?
Yeah, he wasn't terrible all of last year, but the way that it finished was terrible.
Yes.
Like, he was getting beat around.
Well, we were talking about skipping him as they were trying to play for a wild card.
Those were our early shows. We were like, do we want to put him in? I don't know.
Our practice shows. That was like the big thing in our practice shows.
So, yes. Was it a terrible season? No. But was it an up and down season? Absolutely. Is it concerning to me that he had an ERA of 4.37 in his age 34 season and it looked like he wore down over the year despite the numbers on his pitches not really changing too much? Like his, if I recall correctly, and I don't have this number, like these numbers right in front of me, but his spin rate, like certain things that you use as indicators, is velocity. These things didn't really take a dip with Ryu. It was like location. But he's a location-based pitcher, and when he started to miss his spots, he's going to get hit hard as a guy that doesn't have a grade A stuff. He is purely location, location, location. It seemed to be a confidence issue for a lot of it, right? It seemed like he was dealing with, I don't know what's going on, but it's hard not to equate it to a little bit of wear and tear considering that he pitched, what, 160 innings-ish? Yeah, 170 innings last season, and the year before he pitched 60. Then it was 160, then it was 68, 128, 8, and then 0. Like, this guy has not put together back-to-back seasons of 160-plus since 2014-13. So I don't know how you could be going into the season going, I'm confident that Ryu is going to give me close to 200 innings of pitching. Like, no. He's 35 years old. He's always been a guy that you're worried about getting hurt. He just showed that he was having issues with his command for the first time in his career, which is something that is very foreign to him. And, yeah, he's getting paid a lot of money still. The contract is one of those, of course, it's always already worth it contracts because the third year was always the bonus. He was a Cy Young candidate like the first year. And last year, again, if you get 200 innings from a pitcher of pretty decent baseball and you're in the wild card mix, it's right there. But again, Blue Jays missed the playoffs. And if they got a better version of Ryu, would they have made it? Like if they had gotten closer to the guy that they had in 2020, would they have made the playoffs? He's a huge storyline to me. But again, he doesn't speak English. He's kind of a quiet guy who goes about his business. He's unbelievably well-respected, so no one's going to have Ryu hot takes, right? Like, no one's going to doubt the guy, and no one's going to write a hit piece on Ryu or get some information from a teammate where they leak something about not feeling super confident about the way that he looks in spring. He obviously gets the benefit of the doubt. But to me, if we're talking about most interesting Blue Jay stories of 2022, just because you have Gausman and Berríos, to me, and Manoah, doesn't mean that Ryu is not super interesting. He is a massive swing piece. You get him closer to the Cy Young candidate Ryu, and you actually do have the best rotation in baseball. You don't get even, what, 100 innings of Ryu, which is potentially the thing? Like, maybe Ryu's done, and all of a sudden Kikuchi is your number four pitcher, and now you're asking Nate Pearson to start, and now you're going into the minor league system or potentially a trade for another starter. You have to use assets for another starter. It just, there are a lot of ripples to Ryu not being at least close to the Ryu we all want.
And you're right. The troubling thing is that you can't point to one thing necessarily in the profile where you're right. The spin rate, the velocity, if anything, those things ticked slightly up last year versus 2020. So it is a lot about location and sequencing. And one of the things that I think by the end of the year, they were hitting on the broadcast a lot, and you can get into the Statcast data on this stuff, is Ryu is such a finesse guy at the edges of the strike zone. And that got away from him because whether it was because he lost his command or lost his confidence, the stuff that he was missing middle. He wasn't nibbling as well. He wasn't being as difficult to make decisions on if you're a hitter. And that's something, look, we talked to Caleb Joseph about it. We talked to Danny Jansen about it. Ryu, as a guy who throws four, sometimes even more pitches, is not the easiest guy to catch and sequence and things like that. A guy who wants to approach righties differently than he approaches lefties. So there's an element there of, hey, you gotta learn to trust this guy, and he's got to really trust his stuff because you're going to have an element of him, you know, needing to sequence things himself or needing to have confidence in four pitches. Because, yeah, that 90-mile-an-hour fastball, even if the spin rate's there, is not going to blow you away. It's about deception and location. Yeah. So I actually think, you know, it's crossed my mind a couple times, like, hey, we've kind of talked about Nate Pearson a lot in spring training for a guy who might be a swingman in the bullpen, but this is why I think he's so important. And it's not just Ryu. It's that, JD, you watched a lot of Yusei Kikuchi the last couple years, and that's another guy who looks at his best if you're keeping him around, hey, 155, 165 innings, and maybe there's an extra off day in there where, again, the Jays haven't come out and said this, that they're going to do this. The opening day rotation that they laid out had five guys in it. they play 30 games in the first 31 days. It would not at all surprise me if Pearson's role is, hey, even if it's not a sixth starter, you're talking about a piggyback situation, right? Where the idea is, hey, you're going to come in this inning or this many times through the order, and you're going to give us three out of the bullpen, or you're going to give us 50 pitches out of the bullpen. Because, yeah, you don't want to, certainly early in the season, you don't want to overtax Ryu and Kikuchi. And who knows? Like, Ryu had the later arrival because of visa stuff after the lockout. There are a lot of question marks there that I don't think you want to pencil in seven innings every 5 days, or even between the two of them, say 13 innings every 5 days. I think Pearson's a factor here. And Stripling has been less of a conversation because Stripling's a guy we've seen for years now, has done the bullpen role and the starter role, like that swingman role effectively. So it's not as much of a question. But Pearson's not even, I was going to say sneaky important, not even sneaky important to the start of this season especially. His role and his ability to thrive in it is a big deal for keeping Ryu and Kikuchi in good positions.
Ryu, we already like remember his handling has always been one that is uber conservative, and even in 2020, in the season where he'd only pitched 67 innings, he never got to touch the 100 mark. And at the very end of the year, he did, and he looked like a guy who had been worn down for the playoffs. In fact, they end up toying with who goes where. There's controversy as to him not starting the first playoff game, but what was that based in? Well, it was matchup, but it was also they didn't feel like they had a fully healthy Ryu. They thought that he wore down a little bit. He's not, I don't think anyways, you're never getting him into the seventh inning. Like, he is a six-inning guy basically the entire season. My only feeling about the Nate Pearson swingman story is, Stripling is very clearly that bulk. You go in there and you're going to eat some bulk, and that's a role. You've proven that throughout your career, that you can be effective in doing that. Can stretch you out, turn you into a starting pitcher. Sure, sure, sure. Pearson isn't someone that you want to bring with runners on base yet. So is he coming in like, you bring in a reliever to get you out of the scenario that is bringing him out earlier? You have it set where he's getting an inning, he's starting with a clean slate. Like, I am curious to see how they deploy that, but also, one of the things we found out about Ryu as he was struggling is that he's an extremely proud guy. And so what is the mental effect of, hey, every one of your starts, the young fireballer is right behind you, ready to roll. Hey, we're going to have someone that's essentially ready to piggyback you on all your starts. Part of it is just that's the meritocracy, that's the business, that's professional sports. But if we do believe that there is a large part of this that is confidence, and that there is also a large part of it in terms of preserving the player from injury and fatigue, it's kind of a weird balance between the two players, right? And maybe I'm watching too much F1. Maybe I'm trying to buy my Haas gear and I'm thinking about the dynamics between the drivers. But I think there's a little bit of the dynamic between the driver there, especially given that there isn't going to be, you know, open and easy communication between those two guys.
Glad you mentioned F1. And hey, you mentioned Stripling eating bulk. If you want something to chew on that won't bulk you up, it's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
A huge hat tip to our producer, Daniele, for getting us Gunther Steiner yesterday. It's got to be the most shared and excited people have been for any of our interviews on social media. Everyone is on the Haas train. But something to chew on here, you guys both struck out trying to get Haas gear?
So just on the sharing stuff, I went and spoke to a bunch of students at the College Sports Media yesterday, and I did two different classes. It was back-to-back. It was great. Kids were enthusiastic. It was actually like a really bright crop of kids, to the point where I went like, oh, okay, like, going to have to work harder. But they all, like, a bunch of them knew about Steiner, and there were questions about how that gets done, and I was like, okay, Daniele should have been here. I got all these questions that were geared towards Daniele. But thank you to everybody that shared it, and we always appreciate whenever you share this podcast and put it in your socials, retweets, shares on Instagram, telling a friend, whatever. Ailish, I just said it to you during the break of, I wanted to buy Haas gear yesterday. I've long been a Haas guy, all right? Before we got Steiner. And I actually think that one of the tough things with F1 is that some of the gear is tough to wear, right? Like, if you're a Ferrari fan, that's loud stuff, you know? Like, you want to wear Ferrari jacket, you're going to stand out. Red and yellow, like, it's a loud color.
It's also
color.
A little bit of divorced dad energy.
Agree. But, yes, so it's not like there are a lot of things. Like, it's very busy. They're loud. Haas is kind of just clean. I like the logo. It's just nice. The colors are great. There's some merch that I've seen people wear that I go, oh, I would actually rock that around on time to time. I'd like a
Mercedes
Haas hat.
Mercedes stuff is crisp, too. It's just like,
yeah, it is.
It's crisp. It's classy.
That Lewis Hamilton yellow hat is so nice. The Mercedes Lewis Hamilton yellow hat, oh, mm-hmm. Like chef's kiss. But I went to go buy Haas stuff. Couldn't find a damn thing. It's like, first of all, you Google it, and you click on a bunch of websites, and they go, this is not a secure site. And I'm like, what? It says this is the official site of Haas. Can't get on it. Can't get
on
the site.
Yeah, that was strange.
Yeah, you had the same experience.
I had the same thing happen. I thought that I was in some sort of like back end of the internet,
no,
like the dark web, trying to buy Haas gear.
I know. I was like, boy, I know that I – anyway, I'm trying to get this stuff. I'm looking around. Different sites. Can't get a damn thing. Like, I found one hat, and it was sold out. That was it. And then I saw one where I was like, it's in calculated in euros. I got to get this thing shipped in from God knows where in order to get this. I'm going to end up paying duties on it that are going to cost four times the amount of the hat. I hate that, by the way, that you can't just get the duties calculator ahead of time. Why can't we get there as a society?
Like, they'll be like, you'll pay duties and you'll be told when it's already at your door how much it is. You can't turn around and send it back at that point. You're paying whatever they tell you.
$50,
$100, sure, I want the item. You have it in your hands. I guess I'll pay.
Do you know, I had one. I'm not even joking. This happened to me. This is a real thing that happened. I got a package from one of the big places, all right? And I get it, and I pay the fee to get it released, the duties. I receive my item. Then I get a slip in the mail. They're going, hey, it's collections, basically. Hey, we're going to send you to collections if you don't send us more money. I call them. I'm like, oh, I paid this already. And they go, oh, no, we recalculated and you actually owed more. I'm like, what? What kind of scam is that? No, I'm not even kidding. They said that. I was outraged. I'm not paying this. Are you nuts? So you can just arbitrarily be like, oh, yeah, turns out more. I was like, this is blackmail. This is outrageous that you do this. Anyway, Haas, get it together. We gotta get Steiner back on, Daniele. Like, how do we get Haas gear? How do we get some cool merch? How is it that an F1... something that is that big. You want money? How about merch? Where's the merch? You even go to their site, and I can't find it on the F1 site. They don't have their own dock.
They have like four or five different brands you can buy from, and there's no Haas. Like, I'm not going to buy, you know, that a new Alpine racing.
Who's buying Alfa Romeo?
Them.
Who
nobody.
Is it? Nobody wants Alfa Romeo. That is the bottom of the barrel. At least I thought, okay, there's some things here that people would buy. Where is Haas Racing? Where is Haas F1 Racing? Why can we not get gear? Where is the gear? I want the gear.
We got a text in Daniel from Toronto. You can get Haas gear at Fanabox Grand Prix in Montreal at Fanabox GP on Instagram. You can order online. Thank you.
Okay, well,
Daniel.
This sounds like Ailish, you're just reading
buddy.
An ad for this guy, like that he runs the
well,
site. Like,
you know what?
Okay,
if he can get us like, Haas stuff, then yeah. I'm in.
No, like, no offense to Daniel. I appreciate the attempt at a hat tip. They have two Haas shirts on that site, and neither of them are wearable.
Yeah. So there you go. That's what I'm saying. It's like,
well, he's
this
trying.
Is,
I know. I appreciate it, Daniel.
It was just so
if I were a fan
I don't appreciate
of
it.
A
I
lesser team,
it.
You know.
Daniel,
but,
I don't appreciate
very little
your
Haas
attempt.
Stuff. No Yuki Tsunoda gear.
Daniel.
I just watched the Yuki
tip?
Tsunoda episode, by the way.
Yeah.
That guy's a firecracker, I'll tell you that.
That's the word.
I love him. I really love him.
He's good.
He's my favorite driver. He's my favorite driver.
He's like, I need to go poop
that
first.
Makes me feel, That makes me feel validated, by the way, because this is my first time watching the Drive to Survive, and he was the guy that I was, like, really drawn to. And then I mentioned that, and then, like, a lot of other people have been like, oh, yeah, me too. Like, that is the guy. I'm like, okay, good. I'm not some weirdo who's picking the wrong F1 guy.
But I also love that he learned English from the engineers in the paddock. And
you
so it's just it's a very aggressive form of swearing. And it's so great. It's so great. I love it. Yeah. I love everything about the guy. He's got great personality. He's obviously competitive as hell. I don't know what's not to love. Okay. But
hopefully
so,
his car doesn't break down before the race starts next week.
Like I'm not even kidding. Not Daniel, because obviously he didn't even look at this place before sending Blake two bad shirts. But if you're somebody out there that knows how to get Haas gear, right? Like if you're someone who actually spent some time and effort, not just a Daniel that fires away with anything, tries to send me to go to Montreal, then send me the Haas stuff because I want Haas racing gear. I want a hat. I want a sharp hat, maybe even two hats. Oh, maybe want a hoodie. I want some stuff. I won't go jacket. Jacket's too intense, right? Like if you start to wear the jacket, it's just okay. You're not in the paddock. You're not driving the car. Like you don't get to wear the jacket. The windbreaker, too far. T-shirt, fine. Hoodie, fine. Hat, fine. Windbreaker, too far. You got to get it from the team. It's got to be team issued. You got to get it from Steiner himself. Let's take a break. The Raptors have Kyle Lowry this weekend. And it looks like they're actually going to play Kyle Lowry this weekend. Not the up and down, will they, won't they, can they, would they. What would it have looked like if Kyle Lowry stayed? That's next. Fan Morning Show. JD, Blake, and Ailish.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Happy Friday. Blake's Ox Cord, you can check it out on Spotify. We had some good conversations about trying to find Haas gear. A lot of people texting and tweeting and sending us stuff. A lot of it is sold out, so thanks for nothing. But we had a great text.
No, thanks for sending us your first Google search. Like, we didn't, that's not the way we did it too. Oh, did you guys try Google? Oh, wow. I never thought of that. Oh, Google Haas gear. Wow. Thank you so much, listeners.
Lots of attempts. No one has hit it yet, but
no.
We got a text in. Remember Daniel who first sent that text in about the Daniel. Instagram account. Okay. Daniel from Toronto.
At least
we got a text saying, Daniel definitely has those shirts for sure. And Blake just called them unwearable.
I'm picturing him listening to the show right now. And he got one of those shirts and he's wearing it and he's like, ah, I love it. Fan Morning Show, Haas. Blake is my favorite, you guys. Blake is my favorite on the show. And then Blake's like, unwearable.
Look,
he's just sad. Took the shirt off, sucked it in his laundry basket all angry.
Let's be honest. I'm a wrestling fan. My guys at Wrestling Brain do what's called Merch Madness, where they go through some of the worst merch in wrestling history as a regular part of their podcast. Those Haas shirts that he sent belong on Merch Madness up against. Like, it's just a giant picture of a dude, and the back is all huge text. Like, completely unwearable. I'm sorry to that guy, Daniel.
I just have Haas money in the budget now, you know? It's like, I have a surplus, like, in the office where it's buying the copier, where I just don't know.
The copier or the chair? What team are you on?
So I'm here, and I'm on eBay looking at Mick Schumacher autographed Warren Balaclava going, $1,300, not so bad. Nice little piece for the office. I don't know what to do. Somebody let me buy a Haas hat so I can save a grand on buying.
One guy sends in a really good site, and everything's sold out. Like,
thanks for that.
It's wonderful to look at it. Now you've tempted us with this beautiful blue Haas hat, which I would wear, and it's sold out for God knows how long.
There's one shirt I saw that's just Mag Grow, as in like Magnussen Grosjeans. It's also in the Bad Merch Hall of Fame. There's some ugly stuff out here for F1. I got to tell you, there's a lot of ugly stuff.
They need a rebrand.
This is exactly like when UFC started getting big around like 2007-ish, and suddenly everyone was wearing awful Affliction shirts, myself included. Now this is going to be the F1.
Oh.
I had an Affliction shirt, yeah.
We're going to need some pictures of Blake in the Affliction shirt, please.
I think I have a picture somewhere, yeah.
Yes.
Do you remember the Ed Hardy day? When people wore Ed Hardy.
Blake probably wore those too.
No, I didn't.
You guys had Ed Hardy photos. Come on.
Ed Hardy wasn't tough.
Ed Hardy wasn't tough. No, I avoided all that. I never did those things.
Good for you. It's just because you didn't have the body for it, you know?
Well, I was going to say, or the money. I just had to be like lost and found box.
I actually think my Affliction shirt was a gift from my dad, who also had an Affliction shirt. Sorry, Dad. But that's what F1 is doing now. Is like, this is the life cycle of a sport that's rapidly expanding is the merch can't keep up with the fan base, both in terms of merch
can't
quality
keep up
and merch
one
and
thing
merch supply.
Gavin, one shirt one thing that's not a weird half zip polo with 35 different busy things going on. Can we just get that? This is also one of those things where I go, isn't Europe supposed to be fashionable? Like, didn't you guys from what the hell was
what
that? Vic, pay attention to the show, all right? Like, just run the show, Vic. Like, we don't need you playing YouTube videos or whatever the hell it is that you were playing in the background there. Obviously, that was illegal, what you just played. Like, clearly, whatever you just played, illegal. Vic, once again, fired for the 45th time on this show. Okay, Kyle Lowry. We're going to see him this weekend. The Raptors are going to play Lowry. Everybody's fired up. It's going to be an emotional night. The weird thing is that, like, we're in this state now with Kyle Lowry that we found ourselves in with Vince Carter, where we went, how many times are we going to celebrate Vince? Yes, Lowry is the greatest Raptor of all time. There's no question what he means to the franchise. But I do think that at some point you have to go like, hey, we're not doing Kyle Lowry retirement tour every single time they show up. This time will be different. Back in Toronto will be different. That said, it makes me think about one thing, because we've done so many, what are the Kyle Lowry memories and what is this and what is that? Last year when the deadline passed and Lowry was still a Toronto Raptor, there were a lot of people that went, well, Lowry could come back. I was not among them. I thought, boy, now maybe you do have to re-sign him so that you don't let him walk for nothing, because at the time it was kind of portrayed that you were going to get nothing in the sign-in trade. Now that's changed. Precious Achiuwa looks great. The trade looks way more validated with second half Achiuwa. But I think it is interesting just to think about what the Raptors would have looked like had they re-signed Lowry versus keeping Precious. Like, we've seen Van Vliet be worn down at times. This is a team that's, I think, a little bit more competitive than we thought they were going to be. And part of that is the emergence of Barnes. And part of that is the growth of Siakam. Blake Murphy, if the Raptors re-sign Kyle Lowry, and let's say it's the exact same deal he got in Miami, right? Like, there's no hometown discount. There's no nothing. He gets a 3-year contract. How do the Raptors look? How are they different?
So the big thing is the trickle down for the offseason, right? And that's – so all we'll do here – is they don't get Precious. Well, and they don't get Thad. So Precious and Thad aren't here. I think you're still pretty fine with how the rotation looks. Obviously, Precious has been a huge surprise. He's been probably their fifth or sixth best player on the year. That part is real. But Precious has also, as exciting as he's been, not been as impactful as Kyle Lowry. Dunks and Threes, which does EPM, my favorite catch-all, estimates Lowry's been worth about 3 wins more this season than Precious, Thad, and Malachi Flynn put together. So they don't have Precious. They don't have Thad in this case. He's eating some of Malachi Flynn's minutes. The other end of roster guys who soak up some of the minutes, we'll just throw them out because who cares? And Lowry's missed a bunch of games. But you're looking at about 3 wins swing. So this is obviously an inexact science, but the Raptors are only 2 games back of the Philadelphia 76ers for home court in the first round of the playoffs. I don't think it's a long shot to say that if the Raptors have Kyle Lowry and everything else breaks the way that it does with Barnes and Van Vliet and Trent, and those things aren't givens, but let's play it out as if they are, the Raptors are fighting for the top of the Eastern Conference right now. And we're not talking about, hey, they're a team that's annoying to play in the first round. We're talking about, hey, there's not an established 1A at the top of the East. And yes, it looks like Milwaukee more often than not, but Miami doesn't look as threatening. You like how you match up with Boston. You still like how you match up with Philadelphia. You certainly feel like you're better than Chicago. So, yeah, I think Lowry, like Lowry's missed time this year, and I don't know how much Miami games, how many Miami games Raptors fans have watched. He's still averaging 13, 5, and 7.5, and he's still shooting over 37% on a lot of threes. This is not a lead number one guy, Kyle Lowry, anymore, but he's still a very effective version of complimentary Kyle Lowry. His stats are actually most similar to his championship season in terms of volume and usage and things like that. So yeah, I think the Raptors, if Kyle Lowry stays, you don't have Precious, you don't have Thad. Maybe you make one other move to duck the tax or whatever, and you massage at the margins a little differently. But I don't think it's a stretch to say this team that's 44-32 is pushing for 50 wins on the top of the Eastern Conference, at least in the regular season.
So if you look at his advanced numbers over the cumulative stuff, right? Like the win shares, they've gone down. And again, I'm talking about the last 2 years, him in his final year as a Raptor and him in his first year in Miami. His value over replacement is box plus minus, all these things, they're down. Assist percentage, down. His true shooting percentage, actually exact same as last year, which is kind of interesting. That sort of stayed level with Kyle Lowry. But yeah, I think you nailed it where it's like he's not the same guy that he used to be, but that's pretty clear. He's 35 years old. He's not quite in the Chris Paul, I think, echelon of guy that you look at and say, hey, he's still able to maintain all-star level play at an older age despite being a smaller guard, but he's obviously still unbelievably effective. This is a weird one for me because I look at it and go, the Raptors' regular season record is probably better. And obviously you're more talented with Kyle Lowry, but I actually think the way the season has gone has been an unbelievable vindication for this move for the Toronto Raptors. The way that Siakam has emerged, the way that Fred's first half of the season went, and the way that Scottie Barnes has really been able to flourish in a ball handling role, you look at those three things in concert and you go, well, that's enough. Where you would not want to play the rabbit hole game of going backwards and changing any kind of a timeline. But the last piece, and this will be the one that I think is maybe a little bit more controversial, but like, I think Precious Achiuwa right now would be far more valuable than Kyle Lowry. Like, you decide that tomorrow, like, let's say the trade deadline opens up tomorrow, and Lowry's on the trade market and so is Precious Achiuwa, I think you'd be able to get more for Precious than Kyle.
Yeah, but I think that's a long-term consideration in that Precious is young, has two more cheap years, and Kyle is 36 now as of last week.
Absolutely.
And has two more years
but it's just like
I would rather Precious have Kyle Lowry playing for a playoff series right now. But long-term future value, like, yeah, you would basically that something? What they got back for Kyle Lowry looks, you're not going to go the you'd rather have Precious in a playoff series.
All I'm going to say to you is that Precious's defense right now
it's
is
really
so good. And if you look at the Eastern Conference in terms of like the teams they would need to beat and
yep,
the bodies
you want size.
Like the Raptors having, I'm just, to me, it's actually a debate. I know people will hate to hear that and people will think it's nuts, but Precious's defense, having him to throw at, you end up in a series where Embiid is there. He's going to be your most important defender with Embiid. You have a series where you're going to play James Harden in the same game. Like, he's important. You play the Celtics, you need someone to stop Jason Tatum. He's going to be important for that. Like, Precious is not more valuable in a playoff series than Kyle, but I actually think that it's closer than you would just think based on the two names right away on paper. And if you looked at just their numbers over the course of a year, their pedigree over the course of a year, I just think that, yeah, Precious is shooting now and his defense are pretty damn incredible and pretty valuable to this team moving forward. You just said it. He's what? Right now, the Raptors' sixth most important player?
Maybe fifth, depending on how you feel about where Gary Trent's hot and cold offense drops in.
I would say right now Precious is their fifth most important player. And if Lowry was on this team, what number of most important player would he be? Like, we can talk intangibles. It's a harder thing to quantify because Lowry is always a I do everything guy and I give you what you need guy. So yeah, you'd clearly rather have Lowry. Like, you would. You just would rather have Lowry. I just don't think it's a massive gap between the two. And then if you factor in the idea of Precious Achiuwa being more valuable as the long-term play that we recognize, being younger. How old is Precious again?
Not old. 20?
Is he 21?
No, he's older than that. He was a little bit of an overage prospect. I don't have it in front of me, but he's 22. He'll be 23 by the time next season starts.
Okay, so he's 22 years old. Lowry going into age 36 season. I'm actually shocked at how well this has worked out, is all I'm saying. Like, everything that the Raptors would have planned on, when they did the thing of, well, now Siakam can be the man because Lowry's gone, and as much as Lowry was a great teammate, it was suffocating at times a little bit just to not feel as though you could take control of this team. I don't know how you could look at Siakam's progression this year and not think that, hey, this is at least in part his ownership of this basketball team, right? Like,
yeah, the only thing I'd say to that is that the version of Kyle Lowry we've seen in Miami and the version of Kyle Lowry we saw during the championship year is capable of being that complementary piece and moving off ball and primarily being a, you know, dot connector and floor spacer and stuff like that. Miami needs him to run the point a lot. Yeah, exactly. Miami needs him to run the point a lot more than Toronto would. I just think he could continue that evolution. But it's a really interesting hypothetical, not only for the Raptors, for Kyle Lowry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually the one where I look at it when Kyle Lowry and Jimmy Butler was losing it on the bench. And I went, you know, I wonder if you feel any different ways about this. Like, I wonder how you actually would feel if the Raptors play you in a playoff series and you lose to the Raptors. What that full circle feeling would be for Kyle Lowry. And yes, from the basketball standpoint, Blake, I totally agree that Lowry was never a guy that needed to have something. This wasn't you were concerned about how he was going to age from he's the last guy to know he shouldn't be taking the final shot. They were already giving Pascal Siakam the looks at the end of a game. They were already establishing that it was becoming his team. Lowry was obviously a part of that. He understood that. He didn't go to Miami because he wanted to still be the man in an organization. If he prioritized that, he would have prioritized staying in Toronto. I think it's the stuff that you can't quantify, right? It's the feeling of being a leader. It's the feeling of being a little bit taller, feeling like the organization has put faith in you, right? That was so much of the Siakam article that I look back on now and go, this might have meant something, where he said, yeah, sure, they gave me the money. Yeah, sure, they said I was the guy and they gave me the ball, but there are just little things that you really want to feel validated with, and knowing that they were ready to turn the page from Lowry to me, it's hard not to think that that has some type of an impact on the Siakam season, and it's been so good that I just couldn't change it. I can't believe I'm saying it, but I think that they're better off having gone the path that they actually went down.
It's working out pretty well, and when you look at the timelines for Precious and Barnes and those guys, you can be really optimistic about where this team's going. Meanwhile, Kyle Lowry's playing referee in a WrestleMania preview between Jimmy Butler and Udonis Haslam.